Chapter 23. With mounting concerns about Dorothy Kilgallen's JFK assassination investigation, J. Edgar Hoover intensified his investigation of her, as would have, it seems, her other enemies, including Carlos Marcello, the logical chief suspect in the president's death based on motive. FBI files confirmed the director stating in late October 1965, "Find out whether Tannehill, Ruby's attorney, met Dorothy Kilgallen during her stay in Dallas, Feb to March 1964 during Ruby trial, whether he had known her before, if so, the nature of the conversations, and whether she solicited him for any documents re-Ruby." Suddenly, though, the answer to Hoover's request made no difference, since on November 8, 1965, Kilgallen was found dead in her townhouse bedroom. Millions of fans across the country were shocked at losing one of the most remarkable women of her time. From the outset, Kilgallen's death, like Marilyn Monroe's 3 years earlier, was shrouded in mystery, with several of the top NYC newspapers reporting different accounts of how she died, including the discovery of her dead body having happened twice by different people at two different times. To that end, the Journal American on November 9th included the statement, "Kilgallen was found by a maid who went to wake her about noon." A day later, the newspaper revised that account. It reported, "Kilgallen was found dead when her hairdresser arrived at 12:45. In the New York Herald Tribune, reporter Albin Krebs stated that the hairdresser, named for the first time as Mark Sinclair, confirming that he was the one who had discovered Kilgallen's body. The police report, apparently obtained by the Journal American and signed by 19th Precinct Detective John Doyle, mentioned in the ME documents along with Detective Green, provided a third account. Kilgallen, DOA, dead on arrival, was found by maid Mary Eicher between 12 and 1 p.m., lying on back in bed clad in nightclothes. Adding to the confusion, for unknown reasons, the police did not arrive at the Kilgallen townhouse until 3 p.m. By that time, several people had also arrived, including actress Joan Crawford, a close friend of Kilgallen's. According to the NYC Medical Examiner's Office, the official cause was acute ethanol and barbiturate intoxication, circumstances undetermined. When this verdict was announced, no one, not Kilgallen's parents, not her sister, not her children, not her What's My Line colleagues, not her Journal American compatriots, stood up for her and said, "Wait, Dorothy wouldn't overdose. She didn't have a drug problem. She wasn't heavy into alcohol." They just accepted the ME conclusion and accepted that no NYPD investigation was forthcoming. Sad, but true. Meanwhile, according to a report in the New York Herald Tribune on November 16, 1965, 8 days after Kilgallen died, Dr. Luke would not speculate about the form in which Miss Kilgallen had taken the barbiturates. He stated, "We'd rather leave that up in the air," he said. "We don't want to give that out, well, just because." He said that combining alcohol and sleeping pills was a common form of accidental death. Miss Kilgallen had taken on moderate amounts of alcohol and the drug before her death, Dr. Luke said. He wouldn't give any figures. When asked about Dr. Luke's statement during a February 25, 2020 phone interview, Dr. Michael Baden, who assisted Dr. Luke with Kilgallen's autopsy, stated that in his opinion, due to Dr. Luke's admission he did not know what the cause of death really was, what he said went beyond the bounds of what he should have told the media. Unfortunately, when Dr. Luke had announced to the media, and thus to the public, that combining alcohol and sleeping pills was a common form of accidental death, the media and the general public took accidental death as the one and only explanation of the death. But accidental death was not the accurate explanation, as will be proven by new information hidden from the media and the public at the time as part of an enormous cover-up to dismiss any notion that Dorothy Kilgallen was murdered. Similar to the rumors following Marilyn Monroe's death in 1962, rumors swirled around the death of Dorothy Kilgallen during the days after she died. Some actually believed she committed suicide. Others thought the feisty journalist may have been murdered. Then Dr. Luke's comments pointed directly at accidental death, and that was that. No full investigation launched, similar to what happened in Marilyn's death. Regarding suicide, this appears unlikely based on Kilgallen's passion for life since she was at the top of her career. Mark Sinclair certainly believed this was impossible. He said, "Suicide is out of the question. It's just out of the question. She was Catholic, and you know what that means. And she was religiously Catholic." Sinclair added, "Dorothy was very cheerful about life. She was working on her book, very enthusiastically. She was determined to finish it." Eyewitness testimony as to Kilgallen's state of mind shortly before her death comes from at least two credible sources. What's My Line host John Daly described her demeanor on the final program she appeared on by stating, "Dorothy was just full of beans last night. She was in great spirits." Wearing a low-cut dress and appearing as glamorous as ever, Kilgallen laughed at her fellow panelists' remarks. She sat next to future Odd Couple star Tony Randall. Daly's perspective of Kilgallen's final appearance is confirmed by watching that program. Actress Joey Heatherton was the mystery guest, and Kilgallen's questioning of her and the additional guests, including a woman named Eleanor Penna, whom this author interviewed, was first rate. Penna was a football newspaper columnist. Ms. Penna, now an avid collector-dealer of Staffordshire figures, shared a dressing room with Heatherton before Penna's appearance on the program as the final contestant. She stumped the panel, even though Kilgallen guessed her being a writer, but not what type of writer. Penna, 84 years old in 2020, recalled to this author having been around Kilgallen more than 30 times at P.J. Clark's. She said, "My close friend, Daniel Levesso Jr., the owner of the saloon, used to take me to racetracks like Aqueduct and may have even accompanied me to Dick Colmer's restaurant in New Jersey." She added, "At Clark's, Dorothy and I sat at the same table near the back. Dorothy knew me but didn't know me, if you know what I mean, since she was famous and busy with the others who were around. These included Bob Bach, who was very easygoing and fun, and Jean Bach, Arlene Francis and her husband Martin, and sometimes Dick. When she guessed my being a writer on the show, she hadn't put two and two together of our mixing at Clark's." Miss Penna recalled Kilgallen as being prissy, very ladylike, wore those white gloves, had just a slight lisp. Penna said she spent time with Kilgallen after the What's My Line program and recalled her being a bit coquettish, but normal, that her words were not slurred, while adding, "I'd swear she had taken no drugs or alcohol." Throughout the program, Kilgallen smiled and appeared as lively as ever, with no slurring of words. At the end of the program, as the football writer left the stage, Kilgallen kidded Bennett Cerf. Exhibiting her sarcastic sense of humor, she asked whether he might have used the expression "forward pass" when addressing the attractive writer. Instead, Cerf had asked about the woes of his favorite team, the New York Giants. During his videotaped interview, hairdresser Mark Sinclair defended Kilgallen's character, addressing specifically the allegations that she had a drug and alcohol problem. "They'd like you to believe that. They'd like you to believe she drank. She did drink. She was a tough lady. She was able to go out with gangsters and people like that, so she had to be like that. But how could she do the body of work that was done, that everybody professes to, that you can find on tapes, and be an alcoholic and a pill pusher? How do you do that, and she's on television 3 or 4 times a week? How do you do this without someone knowing?" Regarding the program's producers' reaction if they had suspicions of misconduct on Kilgallen's part, he stated, "They would have taken her off the air immediately. They couldn't have let her on drunk." Later in the interview, Sinclair added, "Go look at the tapes a week before she died. She looks beautiful. She's walking around, looks beautiful. I had dinner with her twice that week. I went out for cocktails with her twice that week. She had a limo driver who knew her. The people in the restaurants knew her. People at the theater knew her. How do you hide this pill and drug habit that they say she had? Asked if Kilgallen's face was puffy, her figure shot, Sinclair said, "You can look at the tapes. Was she bloated? Was her figure gone? No, she wore a form-fitting dress. She looked beautiful." Another indication of Kilgallen's intention to continue her career stems from a lunch date she made with record producer D. Anthony, who represented rockers such as Peter Frampton and Joe Cocker. On the Friday before she died, he said Kilgallen had a handwritten note delivered to his Manhattan address. It read, according to Anthony, "You stinker. I haven't seen you in ages. Let's have lunch on Monday," the day she died. Days before Kilgallen died, she had met with famed producer Joseph E. Levine regarding adaptation rights to her new book. She also flew to Las Vegas with Johnny Ray to a Levine bash where they honored Tony Bennett. During the days when Ray and Kilgallen enjoyed a full-blown romance, CBS producer Marlon Swing often accompanied them on evening excursions into the New York City nightlife. When this happened, the threesome chose nicknames. Dorothy was Princess, Ray was King, and Swing was known as Prince Consort. The three also had played restaurant roulette, which meant rendezvous at the best restaurants on an alternating basis, ones like Barbetta and The Colony. Food aplenty was on display, but no check ever arrived at their table. Ray usually passed, but Dorothy and Marlon often went to what were called game parties, where the new game on the block was the song game. Each contestant had to make up a story featuring the blues, one that implied a title. Swing said one evening Dorothy managed to fool the others with a song called "Ah, Sweet Mr. Ree of Life, At Last I Found You." It dealt with a gentleman named Ree, who arrived in the United States without a job, but landed one at Life magazine. Suddenly the man disappeared, only to be discovered at P.J. Clark's. A whiff of Kilgallen's attitudes toward religion came through chats with Swing. Her Catholic beliefs appeared a bit unorthodox, but Swing knew that she did beads whenever Ray flew to a concert. That apparently meant she used the beads of a rosary to count the prayers as she recited them out loud or in her mind. Meanwhile, Kilgallen had been in the midst of completing her new book for Random House about the assassinations. That book would never be released, although Murder One would be 2 years after her death, but without it including any of Kilgallen's evidence about the events in Dallas. There is some dispute as to Kilgallen's contribution to Murder One. In April 1978, Mrs. Phyllis Wagner, formerly Mrs. Bennett Cerf, wrote in a letter that Kilgallen had not completed much, if any, of the manuscript. Wagner said that Kilgallen had missed several deadlines before showing Cerf the preface. Wagner, who had been at odds with Kilgallen before the noted columnist died, also suggested that writer Alan Ullman finished the book based mostly on Kilgallen's newspaper columns detailing the six murder cases. Hairdresser Mark Sinclair noted that Kilgallen was working on the assassinations book. Producer Joseph E. Levine confirmed that Kilgallen had shown him some text from it since they had a meeting on November 3, 1965, to discuss television adaptation of the book. Kilgallen had received a book advance of $10,000. Ruby co-counsel Joe Tannehill, who initially believed Kilgallen had intended the Ruby trial evidence to be part of Murder One, reversed that opinion in 1978 when asked by one of this author's researchers. He said, "You asked why Dorothy never published an account of the episode, her private interview with Ruby. She was in the process of doing a book called Murder One. At least, she and I talked many times over the phone about that book, and I was doing a piece for her which had to do with irresponsible murder as opposed to Murder One. She may have the material that I sent her in her notes." In a videotaped interview, Mark Sinclair stated, I saw her open notes on the assassination and look at them. Murder One wasn't the book she had in mind for those notes. If one reads portions of Murder One, published in 1967 by Random House, it is immediately evident that none of the text deals with the JFK or Lee Harvey Oswald assassinations. However, following the Dorothy Kilgallen to the Reader section at the beginning of the book, it is mentioned that this section accompanied the draft manuscript from which the present book was edited, an indication Kilgallen had written a substantial portion of the Murder One text. Regardless, even if portions of Kilgallen's Journal American articles were used as the basis for the published book, the superb writing, by all accounts, is hers. The back cover of Murder One signaled the celebrity status Random House believed Kilgallen still enjoyed 2 years after she died. A black-and-white photograph of Kilgallen sitting on a desk, telephone pressed to her ear, was featured. On the inside cover flap, the following, in part, appeared. The image of Dorothy Kilgallen as a brilliant, remarkably well-informed member of TV's What's My Line panel and caustic columnist whose Voice of Broadway was devoured daily by millions tends to obscure her record of more than 30 years as one of the nation's top crime reporters. Her byline in the Hearst newspapers was a guarantee of sharp, accurate, and highly readable journalism. From 1934 to 1965, she covered many of the sensational murder trials that once shocked and fascinated the American public. No bleeding heart sob, sister. She went after a story with a vigor and tenacity that frequently bettered the best of her colleagues. The content Kilgallen wrote certainly lived up to the words of praise mentioned earlier. One example was her updating coverage of the infamous Dr. Sam Shepard case. She wrote, "There were a number of reasons for my startled reaction to the jury's verdict. Basically, the state had failed to present anything resembling a conclusive case that established beyond a reasonable doubt the doctor's guilt. Visualization permitting readers to feel as if they were in the courtroom watching the Shepard trial was a Kilgallen specialty." She wrote, "As Dr. Shepard walked with the deputy sheriff across the leaf-covered lawn, their wrists were so close the handcuffs barely showed. He was hatless and ramrod straight in a light brown and tan small-checked topcoat, Burberry style, which he wore unbuttoned. Except for the stern set of his jaw and his pallor, he looked almost collegiate. He might have been, standing in the icy wind, not seeming to notice it, the local high school's football coach." As the Shepard trial had wound down, Kilgallen was quite stunned when defense attorney Arthur E. Petersilge's final argument mirrored the words she had written in a Journal American story a few days earlier. Petersilge stated, "5 months after the murder of Marilyn Shepard, the state does not know how she was killed, with what weapon she was killed, or why she was killed. Yet on the basis of this flimsy evidence, the state is asking you to send Sam Shepard to the electric chair." The prosecution disagreed, calling Dr. Shepard an adulterer, perjurer, and cold-blooded murderer who deserved no mercy for the murder of his pregnant wife. The jury agreed, causing Kilgallen to blister the verdict by writing, "I could not have convicted him of anything except possibly negligence in locking his back door, so I was aghast at the verdict." Dr. Shepard had languished in prison and would, in all likelihood, have remained there for the rest of his life if not for the action Kilgallen took when she met Shepard's appellate counsel, F. Lee Bailey, in New York City. In the corner booth of a plush Manhattan hotel bar, Kilgallen and Bailey, a short bulldog of a man with the smooth mannerisms of a country gentleman, conferred over drinks. In a whispered tone, she told the famous lawyer about an exclusive interview prior to trial she had with Judge Edward Blythen, a pipe-smoking son of a farmer who later became Cleveland's 46th mayor. In 1964, Kilgallen was responsible for the U.S. District Court overturning Shepard's conviction based on her exposing Edward Blythen, the trial judge, for bias. Before the trial, he had told her in confidence his opinion of Shepard's conduct, but she kept silent until the judge died, showing another instance of the integrity she possessed. Author note, the district court decision was affirmed by the Supreme Court in 1966. True to her upholding a strong sense of integrity, Kilgallen, as noted, had not divulged any portion of what she considered a private conversation with Judge Blythen, but when he died, Kilgallen felt it was her duty to do so. In the affidavit she provided Bailey, Kilgallen said the judge summoned her to his chambers due to her celebrity status. He then told her, "I am very glad to see you, Miss Kilgallen. I watch you on television very frequently and enjoy the What's My Line program. But what brings you to Cleveland?" She said she replied, "Well, the case has all the ingredients of what in the newspaper business we call a good murder. It has a very attractive victim who was pregnant, and the accused was an important member of the community, a respectable, very attractive man. Then added to that you have the fact that it was a mystery as to who did it." Judge Blythen, Kilgallen told Bailey, replied, "Mystery? It's an open and shut case." "Well, what do you mean, Judge Blythen?" Kilgallen asked. "Well, he's guilty as hell. There's no question about it," the judge proclaimed. Friends of his later disputed what he told Kilgallen, arguing the judge never used words like hell. Regardless, Kilgallen's disclosure impacted Bailey like a bullet train, and he quickly was able to confirm the judge's bias, since a court clerk had heard a similar remark. These disclosures became the hallmark of Bailey's appeal to the district court and ultimately the Supreme Court decision to free Shepard. Bailey acknowledged Kilgallen's part in securing justice for the doctor. He also said of her, "She was a very bright and very good reporter of criminal cases, the best there was." Confirming Kilgallen's part in helping free Dr. Shepard were emails received by this author from his son, Sam Reese Shepard, in late November 2020. He wrote, "We, my father and I, discussed the case. I was at the SCOTUS hearing, and as I recall, Kilgallen was prominently mentioned by Bailey in the oral argument." Shepard then added that Kilgallen had privately met with Blythen, the judge, in his chambers during the unfair trial one morning before court, and that was the information provided to the court. To Kilgallen's relief, a subsequent jury acquitted Dr. Shepard. Years later, DNA tests confirmed the verdict. The Fugitive television series, starring David Janssen as Dr. Richard Kimball, was a huge success, leading to a film of the same name starring Harrison Ford. The death of Marilyn Shepard remains unsolved. Following Kilgallen's death, Richard Colmer very rarely, if ever, spoke about his marriage to her, and never about her JFK assassination investigation, or any of the circumstances surrounding Kilgallen's passing. Nevertheless, on September 29, 1967, Richard appeared on Long John Nebel, a New York City radio program carried on WOR, the same station that had aired Breakfast with Dorothy and Dick from the mid-1950s. Until his death in 1978, Nebel was a hugely popular all-night radio host with millions of regular listeners. What Richard had to say, as noted in Denial of Justice, is quite important, since there are few people who ever spoke about Kilgallen's work acumen while providing an inside look at some of her personal attributes. Appearing with Richard were Nebel, Paris Flamand, the producer and perpetual panelist on the Nebel program, as well as the author of several books, and Reverend Robert Schrock. Banter among the four men was lively, with Richard first speaking about Kilgallen's work on Murder One. Among the excerpts were, "There is a lot of Q&A in the book, as you know, and I never quite got around to making my point about the Q&A. The reason Dorothy wanted that in there is to prove that a very, very sagacious DA or defense attorney can win the life of a person by asking just the right questions, and it sometimes hangs on one word. And if you read this, and I have reread it, some of the Q&A several times, and you can just see where the scales were tipped, and where the jury decided this is a guilty person or this is not a guilty person. Providing even more information as to Kilgallen's thoughts at the time, Richard said, "Dorothy felt that the Shepherd case was a miscarriage of justice, and yes, F. Lee Bailey himself told Dorothy that, more than any other affidavit that they had, or any statement that had been made, hers influenced getting the guilty verdict reversed by the courts." When Nebel stated, "We were just talking about the passing of Dorothy Kilgallen. I said about a year ago. It's longer, isn't it?" Richard replied, "No, it'll be 2 years, November 8th. And you know, there's an error in the front of Murder 1. Nebel, without asking what the error was, then asked, "Just to get back to the whole crime thing as represented and reflected in the book, did Dorothy prefer, or that's a poor choice of words, find more fascinating the covering of a trial such as, for instance, the Finch-Tregoff trial, which is so incredibly complex and can be very difficult for a mystery story writer to parallel involutions, I should say the convolutions, or did she, was she, was there a depressing element that made her sometimes wish to eschew coverages of this sort?" After pausing, Richard replied, "She'd had so much experience with this matter of crime and murder that I think she approached these things absolutely objectively. I mean, she was human, for heaven's sake. She frowned upon sin and always regretted that a murder had taken place." To Paris Flammonde, stating, "Oh, of course, but I was wondering, the play between the fascination and the obviously depressing qualities of a trial must rather tear a person." Richard replied, "She worked so darn hard, Paris, every time she covered a trial. It just became a challenge to her. She couldn't, whenever she read about some mysterious death and there were important, a beautiful girl, and the cast was right, and a wealthy boy, and there were four suspects, and who did it, and it looked as though it was going to be a humdinger, she couldn't wait to get on a plane to go to Chicago or California or any place. And she rarely slept. She would go right from the courtroom back to her hotel room, get at the typewriter, and knock out hundreds and hundreds of thousands of words, particularly in these long trials, like that Finch-Tregoff trial was quite long. The Shepherd trial." Regarding other events Kilgallen covered, Richard said, "One, it was not a murder case, but it was an international scandal, the Perfumo case in England. She flew to London for that and covered the whole thing right up to the day when the poor guy killed himself, took his own life. She also covered two coronations over there that, of course, have nothing to do with trials at all, and she covered the wedding of Princess Grace in Monaco, and she flew around the world." He added, "A very really amusing experience would be to watch a television program with Dorothy like Perry Mason or The Defenders. She was so familiar with court procedure and the techniques of lawyers and how they try to trip up witnesses and how when they're supposed to jump to their feet and say, 'Objection,' that if the script was written wrong, in her opinion, she would yell at the actor, 'You idiot, why would you object? It's irrelevant, it's immaterial,' or 'The judge wouldn't have let him get away with that.' Oh, she'd get very upset." How Kilgallen reacted to television shows like Perry Mason is quite revealing, with her criticizing those who presented what she believed was more fiction than fact about the courtroom dramas. As a woman of the truth, any deviation from that truth offended her. One person who knew Kilgallen well from the Jack Ruby trial, his co-counsel Joe Tannehill, described her just months before she died. Asked by this author's researcher whether he believed Kilgallen was a troubled woman on the downhill of her life, with drug or alcohol issues, he answered, "She wasn't struggling with any substance abuse problems or anything. I went to dinner with her at the 21 Club in New York City in July 1965. She didn't drink much, maybe one vodka tonic. That was about it. He added, she didn't show any indication of being an alcoholic to me, or any drug use. She had a good mind, and her mind was working, very realistically and very effectively. Tannehill also disclosed that Kilgallen, just a week before her death, spoke to him about appearing on a radio show together to discuss the JFK assassination and Ruby. He intimated that she was as sharp as ever. With these accounts in mind, the key to challenging the medical examiner's official report of the cause of Kilgallen's death, claiming the death to be accidental due to a drug overdose mixed with alcohol, lies not only in examining the autopsy report in detail, but more importantly, the state of affairs at the Manhattan Medical Examiner's office when it took control of the famous journalist's body